Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven. Alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad. Let's see. Dr. Riley? Sure, we'll go with that.
Sure. Hi. I just got an upgrade.
And Spencer Orderly Williams.
Wow.
Oh.
I'm exactly where I thought I would be.
We got a great show in store for us as we are doing a double feature. We haven't done a double feature in a long while.
Like a long while.
Yeah, and I think it's high time that we bring that back. And what better way to bring back a double feature than to talk about the end of the world, right?
Right.
Right?
Binge-worthy-ish, maybe, end of the world.
So stick around as we dive into that. But before we do, Chad, give him a little bit of that opening info.
Sure will. From beginning to end, the Filmlosophers podcast is brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios. And when you're looking for recommendations on what to watch or what to avoid on Netflix or other platforms, we've got the details you need to make the right choice about more than 130 films. And the number grows every week. Subscribe to the Filmlosophers on your streaming platform of choice and pick up new episodes each Wednesday morning. You can't miss us. We're on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom, among others.
We're Mr. Worldwide.
Even when your questions aren't about life or death matters, we'd still like to hear from you. Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Like our page on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. We haven't reached the end of human history, but we're rapidly approaching.
That's positive.
That optimism we hired you for?
Okay. Well, we still have time to reach into our episode archive and find a favorite or two. Access our entire library of great content on our website at filmlosophers.com.
That's right. Or you can check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at filmlosophy101. So, yeah, there's lots of places where you can check us out. But before you do that, like we said, we have a special edition of the Filmlosophers today as we are talking about a double feature on the end of the world.
Basically, none of us had important weekend plans, so we hopped on Netflix and watched two movies back to back.
It's true. No joke, that is exactly what we did.
Literally what happened.
So we went and perused the Netflix library, if you will, and we came up with two films that we thought kind of exemplified that end-of-the-world mindset. And those films are How It Ends and Extinction.
Both of which were distributed by Netflix.
That's right.
So they did not go to theaters. They went straight to Netflix.
That's right. And because these films are on Netflix, we will be talking about spoilers. So fair warning. That's where we're headed.
Yeah, because y'all can pause the episode, spend 3.5 hours watching both of them back to back, and start the episode again if you really care that deeply. So we're going to spoil.
There you go. So before we get into the review, Chad, why don't you give them the synopsis of the first film?
The first film, How It Ends. After an unknown cataclysmic event on the U.S. West Coast, a devoted father sets out on a 2,000-mile journey from Chicago to rescue his daughter from Seattle. During the journey, an unlikely bond develops between him and his potentially future son-in-law as they are forced to deal with a collapse in, well, basically everything. Humanity becomes immediately desperate to stay alive, and nobody knows what exactly took place to cause everything.
It's true. Directed by David Rosenthal, the film stars Theo James, Forest Whitaker, Grace Dove, Cat Graham, and Mark O'Brien. And then, moving over to the second film, I think I'm going to toss this over to Spence. Spence, why don't you read that second synopsis for us, if you will?
I didn't prep for this.
I know you didn't.
A family man is plagued by dreams of loss, but his dreams turn out to be more than prophetic. The paranoid, when the planet is attacked by an off-world invasion, as he fights to protect the people he loves, he discovers he has a hidden strength that can keep him safe from harm. That sounds so ridiculous.
I know. Both of these descriptions. Where do you find these synopses?
These are official synopses from Netflix themselves.
Well, that first one didn't even really mention that there was a second person.
No, there was like a super typo that I tried to go ahead and smooth over. So
yeah, that was odd.
Tell you what,
you can put that complaint Netflix.
in the Netflix complaint box.
I can put the complaint in the Eddie complaint box. Read this stuff before you copy and paste.
Directed by Ben Young, the film stars Lizzie Kaplan, Michael Pena, Mike Coulter, Lily Aspel, Emma Booth, Israel Broussard, and Lex Shrapnel.
What an incredible last name.
Lex Shrapnel. That's like one of those 80s movie action stars that, like, you know, they're always in every film. Starring Lex Shrapnel.
I mean, with a name like that, you can sell movies.
Yeah, it's totally a stage name. It's gotta be. I mean, who has a family named Shrapnel? I mean, maybe, I don't know. Probably people in Europe.
It split off from the top. Never mind.
No, that's not a stage name. That's his actual name.
Shrapnel. Well, I mean, hey, not everybody can have a regular name. Both films debuted on Netflix during the month of July, with How It Ends debuting on the 13th and Extinction on the 27th. So these films have been on Netflix for a little over a month, actually close to 2 months. And so there's been plenty of time for you to, you know, jump in and check these films out. And like we said, we got a chance to see these films recently this past weekend. And in all honesty, I didn't really know what to expect with these types of films, because whenever you come to Netflix, you're usually either going to see their streaming of popular films that they're known for, films that
are already established. They already did their theater run and
exactly
up for grabs.
And then you have your outstanding works, like your outstanding pieces that Netflix puts out. Like, obviously, Glow was a really popular one. It got a lot of attention this past week with the Emmys. You had what once was one of its hallmark series, House of Cards, which apparently is coming back with the final season. You have a lot of shows and some films that really stand out that are put out by Netflix, which Netflix has kind of become the end-all for producers and studios and filmmakers who want to put out a piece but don't want to be bogged down by, you know, certain requirements or a lot of that politics with studios and all that kind of stuff.
Right, and there's a whole rigmarole, especially with television shows, with regard to how a TV show even gets made. You have to get the pilot greenlit and made, and then the pilot gets shopped around, and there are months and months, sometimes up to a year, in between when the pilot was shot and when you even get the approval to film a second episode, let alone an entire season. You know, the Netflix model shortcuts all of that and says, well, yeah, we'll greenlight an entire season. It's not 22 episodes, but it's a solid 8 to 10 usually, and if it does well, then they'll immediately greenlight another one. So it's a fast track approach in terms of television, like serialized TV show type content. Movies they have not been as successful with, and in all honesty, they typically seem to still be picking up movies that other studios don't want to put into theaters.
Yeah,
and Netflix becomes the theater, if you will.
100%, because we kind of fell into this particular situation when the last time we reviewed something from Netflix, The Little Prince, there was a whole snafu between
Paramount was not. Paramount was originally going to distribute The Little Prince in North America, and they backed out at the last minute. Mm-hmm. And Netflix stepped in and said, "Well, we'll put you on our platform."
Yeah, and essentially that's kind of been the model for most films that make their way to Netflix. If they can't find that open door that they're looking for via the mainstream theaters and cinema, they'll take their project and they'll go to Netflix. And Netflix has been investing quite a bit into a lot of their new content. I think there was a number, and I don't know it offhand, and I should have looked this up, but there was a number that they had said at the beginning of this year that they were stating they were going to release this much new content this year alone, and it was substantial. It was in, I want to say, in the hundreds in terms of brand new content coming from the streaming platform, which you look at a streaming platform and you're like, oh, this is solely for streaming the movies or the shows that I know and love from, you know, your well-known networks like Fox or, you know, ABC or NBC, or, you know, seeing the movies that, you know, you can catch that you really love, like all those 80 films like Top Gun, or watching things like it was like that mindset. You know, that's usually what you go to a streaming platform for. And now Netflix has kind of paved the way for other streaming platforms to realize that they can actually create original content, and it can be popular, it can be good, it can be substantially better than what most people are used to on TV.
Well, and at the very least, there's the notion of self-selection. You know, you've got basically the most robust cable channel in the world, or what we would traditionally call a cable channel, but all the content is on demand. So, and it even is smart enough algorithmically to suggest other content based on what you've already shown an interest in.
Yeah.
You know, your list, Eddie, and your list, Spencer, and my list, they don't
Chad.
Look the same.
Sorry.
Like when not only the wish list of like what we've got in the queue, but when you look at other recommended movies, it's based on, or TV shows, it's based on what we've already each individually viewed, which is brilliant, because it, you know, kind of like the, you know, the old, PSA commercials that were anti-drugs, and it was the rats that kept going, like the albino rats that kept going to the nicotine drip.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because like, oh, yeah, give me another hit, give me another hit, give me another hit. It's sort of like the thinking man's version of, well, not even necessarily that. Some of it's just ridiculous entertainment value that's not terribly intelligent, but, you know, you kind of go for this highly personalized, highly customized approach to all sorts of content from even around the world.
Yeah. Spence, we were just talking a little bit before we got on about kind of the music. Like, if you were listening to the episode, you heard that iconic song about it's the end of the world. It's been in just about every other, you know, film in these types of circumstances, the apocalyptic scenes. What are some of your favorite apocalyptic films outside of, obviously, from what we saw? Like, because you're looking at, like, films like Armageddon, Deep
and
Impact.
And don't feel limited to, like, films that other people would know. If you have a B-movie or two that you love, go ahead and mention that, too.
Or an anime, or even, like, a television TV movie, or I know one of the ones that Chad usually talks about quite a bit, and I always mean to kind of look into it, but I never get a chance to, was, like, Jericho. Jericho was one of those types of shows.
Oh, yeah, that was a show on CBS for, like, a season and a half.
But
you got this short stick.
But you said it was a really good series.
The first season was super, super good.
Yeah.
Very compelling. The setup basically is multiple nuclear explosions are set off in key areas around the United States and possibly other areas of the world. And this small town of Jericho, they're trying to figure out what happened, what they need to do. Does the country even exist anymore? Like, who's still alive, who's not? And it was a really compelling look at, you know, when you're cut off, when your lines of communication are totally cut off, and all you have is the people around you in your immediate circle, your immediate community, you know, what do you do? What decisions do you make differently? And
yeah,
how do you, you know, pull together and survive? It was a really cool show.
Yeah. Spence, did that give you enough time to kind of come to and think about it?
Actually, now like I'm thinking about it, I don't think I really watch a lot of like apocalyptic stuff, because I'm like pulling from other mediums. It's like, this Fallout 4 count? No.
No.
Yeah, because like I actually saw Jericho as well, and I didn't like it. I thought it was kind of slow
for
me.
Wow.
But that's like the only one.
Chad,
I can really
quick,
think
cover
of
your ears. You don't want to hear
it. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. Also, it was like, what, 10 years ago?
Yeah,
almost?
It was.
I mean, it's been a while.
Like a long time ago.
Spencer. I mean, there's a lot that are out there. Like, I mean, if you take a look, one of the great ones that just recently, well, not recently, but as of late, within the last maybe 15 years, maybe more, maybe 15, 20 years, I actually enjoyed was Book of Eli. I thought Book of Eli was a great film. Denzel Washington, Mila Kunis. He's this, you know, traveling man who's going from one side of the world to another to deliver this large Bible, which may happen to be like the last Bible in the entire world, so that it can be replicated, so that the Bible can be created and distributed to other people. And the way that film was set up and the way the world was set up, because I mean, you look at apocalyptic type worlds, so you look at that type of setting, you're usually used to like Mad Max, or you're used right. to like, and this, although it was kind of set in that way, and it might just be Denzel Washington, because Denzel Washington's amazing in anything he's in, but like, he just set this film on a whole different level. And I mean, you had a great cast in that film. You had Denzel Washington, you had Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
I mean, those two heavy hitters alone made that film for me. Gary Oldman kind of jumping back into his roots as being a villain in that
particular
film.
I was going to say, he's a bad guy again in that one.
Yeah. It was great. And I think for me, that was one of those films that really stuck out as a unique yet still fun and engaging type of end-of-the-world film. And then I know the age-old debate going back and forth between Armageddon and Deep Impact. I just to kind of throw my hat into that mindset, I actually enjoyed Deep Impact more than I enjoyed Armageddon. I mean, it might be that it had Elijah Wood. It might be that it had Robert Duvall.
Elijah Wood. Elijah Wood is your trump card in that debate over Aerosmith?
Frodo, man. Frodo.
Don't want to close my eyes. I don't want to fall asleep. I've never looked at animal crackers the same way.
Ah.
No, I prefer Deep Impact also. But not because of Elijah Wood.
It was Robert Duvall, Morgan Freeman. What is that woman's name? The woman who plays the... I forget, one of the main actresses that's in that film as well.
Well, you've got, what, Lili Sobieski, who's Elijah Wood's girlfriend. They're trying to escape the wave, like the literal, like tidal wave, not like the wave in the football stadium, but...
Tia Leone.
Sorry. Oh, Tia Leone, yeah. She was the news reporter, and her dad, she had to go, like, repair her relationship with her dad, and...
Just that whole movie.
Well, because the whole subtext, the whole reason for that movie, it was less about the celestial events and the end of the world, and more about... the emotions. That's why it had the title that it did. It was about, it was a deep movie. It was not a, it had spectacle in it, but it, unlike Armageddon, it wasn't about the spectacle.
Yeah.
Armageddon had some depth in it, but was about the spectacle. They were kind of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. So after I've already gone and Chad, Spencer, have you figured out which one you're going
to
pick?
Okay. First, I didn't realize we were boomeranging back to me.
Yeah.
Because, like, I've spent, like, the last couple of minutes researching what even is an apocalyptic film versus a post-apocalyptic film. So,
First
off, The Book of Eli is a
post-apocalyptic
film, not an apocalyptic film, just so you know.
Thank you, Spencer.
Hey, if I'm going to learn...
We are the Thinking Man's Film Podcast, so it's valid. It right.
That's a great
point. The
motion
carries.
There you go.
Go on.
Well, that's all I've got so far. It's hard to do research while I'm listening to both of you guys talk. But you were talking and going back and forth
because
between
our conversation is just so darn compelling.
It
has nothing to do with how annoying our voices are.
Or how similar we sound.
I can't get any thinking done with you guys talking all the time.
We've heard that before, so that's okay.
Okay, but I'm going to, between Deep Impact and...
You're gonna go that route.
Armageddon.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like Armageddon better.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it because it's Michael Bay?
It's because
Michael
it's,
Boom Boom Bay.
It's ridiculous.
Okay. This That's was what? Before it, Michael Bay was
kinda.
A more of a laughing thing. Like this.
Well, okay.
It is one of his absolute better films.
Oh, 100%.
Like
this. Yeah.
It's actually a balanced film.
Oh,
even
no
in
doubt.
Spite of the spectacle.
Yeah. Like this
which
is before
you don't get in almost any other Michael Bay property.
No, it's kind of weird now.
100%. Like this is right before Michael Bay started going nuts and being weird and disgusting. And Michael Bay, that's a whole nother episode we're going to have to get into. But understanding that we have our experience in end-of-the-world films, and obviously the expectations in most of those end-of-the-world films are you have some type of inciting incident, you see that the world is in peril, and you're recognizing that somebody or a group of somebodies has to step up to either stop this or save those that they love.
Sure.
That's essentially...
So, Spencer, just to give you just an example, basically look into Roland Emmerich. Mm. So you've got Independence Day. Mm-hmm. You've got The Day After Tomorrow. You've got 2012. I'm like, I don't remember the exact date it was going to happen. You know, but basically all of those films mm-hmm. would be apocalyptic films. Now, those are more on the spectacle side than the two that we saw on Netflix over the weekend.
Yeah.
And that you could see at any time if you so choose.
I like 28 days later. How about that? Does that count?
Ah, okay. 28 days later. Yes. Not 28 weeks later.
Yes.
Okay, 28 days later. That's interesting because that's more of a zombie end of the world type film.
Still counts.
No, I'm not saying
totally counts.
I'm not saying it. I'm actually rather intrigued that you would choose something that's more into the horror aspect for that particular film. Selection.
Yeah, no, I remember that being like really well done. I really liked it.
Oh, it was an incredible film.
Mm-hmm. What about World War Z?
Brad Pitt.
Yeah, that one was good. That one
long-haired
surprised
Brad
me.
Pitt.
Yeah, that one surprised me that I liked it because like I remember I saw the trailer. I was like, this isn't gonna be any good.
But here's what didn't work for me in that movie:
the ending.
No, the zombie ladder toward the helicopter.
Oh yeah,
where they made a human ladder of themselves. They lost me. They completely lost me in that moment.
They were literally locking themselves each other so they could next
like I did not watch the rest of the movie. I was in the theater and I did not want to see the rest of it. I'm like, that is garbage.
Did you leave?
No, I watched the whole thing. I lost interest because that just was dumb.
Oddly enough,
the rest of it was really interesting.
Yeah,
I thought.
It was. Oddly enough, one of the more recent ones that I saw that actually, and we'll keep moving after this, but that Steve Carell did that I thought wasn't bad was that Seeking a Friend for the End of the World back
that
in 2012.
Was sad, though.
It was sad. Obviously,
was like
the world ended.
Morose.
But I think it was a good opportunity to kind of see Steve Carell step out.
Was in with that? Keira Knightley. Yeah.
But I actually enjoyed that one as well. So, jumping into these two films, as we stated, they star a slew of well-known names. You have Forest Whitaker in one of them. You have Lizzie Kaplan, Michael Peña, Mike Coulter, who is actually Luke Cage from the Luke Cage series on Netflix. Theo James, if you're unfamiliar with him, he played Four in the Divergent series films. I think actually just the two films. I don't think they've actually done all three.
I don't know. I think they did the first half of the third one, and then they tried to turn it into a TV series instead because nobody wanted to see the movie
anymore. Thank God it died.
And Shailene Woodley said, heck no, I'm going to do movies. I'm not going to sign on to finish this mess on television. Not that that's a knock against television. I prefer television as a format, but... that was just a hot mess, and it was ill-advised for them to adapt that television or that series into a series of movies anyway. I don't know. He's been in something else. What was the other thing that most people? Black Mirror, wasn't he in one of the?
Oh yeah, he was
Black
in
Mirror
one of the episodes of Black
episodes.
Mirror.
So if you haven't seen the Divergent series, you might have seen him there.
True,
he's probably done a few other things, but
that's actually a really good point. He was in that one. Also, he did an Underworld film. A lot of little other minor things here and
there. Has yet to carry a property.
Yeah, exactly. He has yet to have that ability to lead something like that. So, in all honesty, these films are in the mindset of there is a looming threat, there is something that is happening, there is a cataclysmic event that is occurring that either has occurred and is making its way towards them, or it's imminent and it's about to occur. And I think that's one of the things that obviously all end of the world films, they get right. I mean, obviously you got to have a big event. Here's my issue with...
Yeah, usually with the end of the world, the setup is not the problem.
No. But with one of our films that is aptly titled, How It Ends, the sad thing about this film is that you really don't find out what exactly it is that's kind of happening in the film. like, there's a lot that's going on in terms of, like, oh, well, you know that something happened in the West Coast. It started in the ocean. It caused a tidal wave. It's causing this, you know, this ash to fall on the ground. Stuff is happening. But you're not really aware of what it is. And throughout the entire film, you're kind of like, I wonder what this could be. Like, we actually were placing bets earlier on in the film. They're like, I bet it was the magnetic poles. No, I bet it was the birds. No, I bet it was, you know, John Hamm. I don't know.
NATO.
Oh, gosh. Please, no. We did that episode already. Please.
I know. I don't have my episode list up right now. I'm used to plugging that now. It was recent.
But that's a problem for that particular film. Right off the bat, you're strung along on this story that, I mean, in the most basic of needs when it comes to these types of films, you kind of want that story to have closure. Not the entire story. Like, I could care less if everybody else's plan, you know, is going to end up dying. That's fine. Whatever. You know, the nature of the film and the story and whatnot. If it serves a purpose for the entire film, by all means, kill off whoever you need to. But if you're not going to resolve that particular part of the story, I feel like that then you're kind of missing a huge piece of what's going on.
I agree with you in many, many ways. I think that there are times when you can sidestep a literal, like, point-for-point logical explanation. And I'm thinking very specifically of Arrival, where if you execute the story elegantly enough and you transition from what you thought the story was about to what it's actually about, I think there is a way to not just end the story, but really bookend the story in an appropriate way.
Yeah.
That feels like you've closed the circle, you've closed the loop. Yeah. Even if you don't get, like, well, what happened on the West Coast?
Yeah, yeah.
And in this film, how it ends, I think that feeling of closure is lacking.
Yeah.
And part of the reason is because you are so completely in the dark.
Oh, yeah,
the
100%.
Whole time. You never know, even when you as the audience have a chance to view part of Seattle and you have a chance to see the after effect of whatever it was that happened, and then you still don't know what happened.
Yeah.
I think that definitely in more... in more capable hands, storytelling wise, I think that it wouldn't have been as much of an issue if they did a better job sort of paying off the character focus that they're attempting. But they do so many set pieces and, like, skirmish sequences throughout the film that it really doesn't get to be the character study that it is trying to be.
Yeah.
Because you're really just doing skirmish. It's very Mad Max in that way.
Oh, yeah.
And or I was thinking also of The Road, which is an adaptation of a Cormac McCarthy book. Yeah. The book is phenomenal. The movie is a little difficult to get
through.
Viggo
Mortensen, right?
Yeah. And Charlize Theron,
yeah,
very briefly. But this is sort of like, you know, that story, the book and movie, are set sort of, I think, 20 or 30 years into a post-apocalyptic type of environment, whereas this is, as Spencer was very aptly drawing that designation, this is very much in the moment when an apocalyptic scenario is playing out.
Yeah. And what do you think about that, Spencer? How'd you feel about the way this film carries that particular part of the story? Being able to not fully translate the way the actual event, just in terms of, like, origin or maybe even some kind of information. Because in all honesty, we have no clue what happened. Like, we have glimpses of the fact that, okay, whatever it was caused a big, you know, tidal wave, but it's also causing a lot of other things to occur. There's, like, these insane electrical storms that are happening, these insane rain weather patterns. It's causing chaos and just mayhem all clear across the United States, as we know of. Who knows if it's worldwide? We don't kind of reach out that far in terms of understanding what's happening outside of the United States. But with everything that's happening, it felt like it was building to a point. It was building to a moment to where, like, the realization of what it was going to, like, make everything make sense. And that never happened for me. And it was frustrating. I'm not going to lie. I was frustrated. I was like, this is stupid. Like, the credits rolled, and I'm like, what the heck? What happened? So how do you feel, though, about a story that shows an event or shows the apocalyptic event that is happening but doesn't deliver on at least resolving that part of the story?
Well, I think it's terrible. But, like, the main problem is that it gives you, like, tons of pieces of things that don't fit together. And so you spend a lot of your time, like, trying to make, like, a puzzle picture out of, like, a bunch of pieces. For instance, when they get into Seattle, there's, like, very clear part where he gets back to his old apartment, and there's, like, a straight line cut through the city, but they never really talk about what caused it or how that relates to, like, lightning. And it's really odd because, like, you know, tsunami's not going to do that. Then near the end of the movie, they're being chased by this fire cloud that just rolled over, like, the city. And I don't even understand what that's supposed to be coming from, because it seems like at that point the movie is just trying to attack them. It's like, ah, get away from here. Rah, rah. And then it just gives up.
Valid point.
Rah, rah, rah. Yeah, it just gives up at a certain point for no reason when it really shouldn't have, and they drive off into the green hills of Apocalyptica. Or, like,
Apocalyptica?
Yeah, I don't
also
know.
Also known as Canada.
All right, they were going north.
They were going north.
I forgot about that.
There you go.
But, like, I don't even...
Sorry, Canada. He didn't mean anything by it.
I thought they were going back to the east. My bad. But it makes it really hard to really have, like, a sense of, like, oh, they're going to be okay, or they're going to survive when, like, the ground could just open up and swallow them whole based on whatever, because I don't even know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, no, that's a valid point. There are a lot of when the story willfully withholds information from you, and you're left with a bunch of clues, and you're trying to put the clues together. It's a bit of a disservice to the audience to never, ever give them something that that helps explain all of it. The closest that you get is a character that you meet in, like, the final 15 minutes of the film who has, like, a conspiracy theory of what has happened, and that's the closest that you ever get to any sort of a unified message about what could have caused all of this chaos.
Yeah.
Right, and that's kind of really frustrating because you can't even, like, you don't feel like you can even trust what the character's saying at the time
either. Oh, absolutely. The way that they play that character off, he's completely untrustworthy.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was just super awkward the way they presented the character, the way they allowed the character to kind of fully manifest as into his true intentions, and the way that whole scene plays out. And it's like, dude, you're literally just, you've been on screen for like 5 minutes. Tone it down a bit, like, take it back a bit. and normally when we start out these particular reviews, yes, we start with characters, but I think this is a big character in these films that needs to be done right in terms of, like, when you talk about characters, obviously we talk about the hero, talk about the villain, we talk about the sidekicks, we talk about the henchmen, we talk about all these different aspects of characters. But when you're looking at end of the world type films, the largest and most impactful character that is in these is the inciting incident. Like, that will help shape how the whole film is going to essentially be served to the audience, in my mind, you know. And that's kind of how these films, that has to be done right. If not, you're going to start losing people, because then they no longer are invested into whether or not this event is going to destroy the world. Plain and simple.
Well, and you've got sort of that that logical progression that needs to be there. I would say if we were comparing these two films, and we haven't delved too deeply into Extinction yet, but both films And this is actually not uncommon in apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic storytelling. They don't show all their cards in the very beginning. Both films withhold key elements of the story in the beginning. Extinction does it more elegantly and more effectively than How It Ends.
Yeah.
And I think that one thing that Extinction did better, because the heart of any compelling story is conflict. That is writing 101. If you ever go to a writing seminar or whatever, you have to have tension. You have to be able to either resolve or escalate that tension. And that can be psychological, it can be emotional, it can be man versus nature, man versus himself, man, like whatever, woman versus herself. It can be any number of different factors in each of these scenarios. You know, you've got really your characters versus fate, you know, whether that's natural causes or like, you know, natural disasters or military conflict or whatever it may be. And so each scene essentially needs to have its own conflict that gets resolved or escalated to keep the story going toward its big finish. And I think one of the things that the team behind Extinction really understood was that even though, yes, you need to go from conflict to conflict to conflict to conflict and change up, like, is he fighting with himself? Is he fighting with his wife? Is he fighting with some soldier from another world? But also, as you go along, you do need to kind of leave breadcrumbs for the audience to start building an explanation for why any of this is happening in the first place.
Yeah. And even with those breadcrumbs, if those lead to, like, a half-burned-down, you know, house made of sweets or candy, I mean, at least that's something better than nothing. You know, it doesn't have to be, like Chad said, the full picture, but it does need to give some type of recognition to the audience. You don't want to make your audience feel like they've been dragged around for almost 2 hours just to see these characters drive off or get killed and not explain the inciting incident or not give some type of inkling. There has to be some kind of payoff for that. Mm-hmm. And to Chad's mention, you know, with Extinction does that actually very well in the fact that it's constantly creating this looming fear within the main character played by Michael Peña as he's having these dreams and he's seeing that something's going to happen, something will happen, and he knows it. And in almost a prophetic fashion, he's believing that it's going to happen. He doesn't want to get help, but these dreams seem so vivid to him that he knows for sure something is bound to occur in the near future. And I think that's great in terms of building the story, because with that, when it actually happens and when the hammer falls, you are, in certain aspects, you are so relieved because you're like, yes, number one, he wasn't crazy. And number two, you're finally seeing what so many people, what you come to find out, so many others have actually been remembering or seeing or visiting or having visions of. It's actually coming to pass. Like, you're seeing it fully play out. And it's rewarding as a viewer.
It is rewarding. And it's nice to kind of have that build up and see a little bit of a payoff intellectually before the movie's over. Certainly in comparison to How It Ends, to have any sort of intellectual relief at all is helpful, because How It Ends, on the other hand, just goes conflict, 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 conflict. And at best, you get a resolution to the question of, you know, do one or more characters make it to the West Coast? Like, that's basically the best form of resolution you get.
Yeah.
The conflicts themselves don't really add much to the story aside from obstacles that need to be overcome.
I mean, if that's the case, that's the same premise of any road trip I used to take with my family. Like, who was going to survive once we got to the place? Because everybody was trying to kill each other. And that's kind of in jest and also in seriousness, because then if that's the case, then it removes itself from that apocalyptic genre. It removes itself from that, you know, end of the world status, because then you just have this incident that's just completely on the back end. It's on the back burner. There's no importance placed on it. It seems like there's importance placed on it, but when the film finally ends, you see that there wasn't really any importance placed on it, or else there would have been some type of resolution for that.
You know, the trailer for this movie, like, made me not want to see it because it was kind of like that, too. Because, like, it opens talking about, like, oh, something happened on the West Coast. Oh, no, my girlfriend's over there. But then it slowly just slides into this. It's about Forrest Whitaker and this guy taking a road trip across country, and it's going to be crazy and wild. And I did not want to
be crazy and wild.
Stuck in a car with Forrest Whitaker for like the next hour and a half. It just seems like a lot.
And speaking of Forrest Whitaker and Michael Pena, kind of jumping into the actual performers of this film, you know, you have
these films. They were in two different ones.
They were in two different ones, yeah. With starting with How It Ends. Honestly, the main standout for me was Forrest Whitaker. I mean, by far, that was probably the only one that really was memorable enough. Theo James did okay, but, I mean, you can't really step up when people like Forrest Whitaker are in the scene.
Or when your script writers decide to use the same word for 50% of the dialogue ever in the movie.
It really was. Like, this film was...
those of you with children in the house that might care to know this, the F word is used, like, literally half of the words in the script are the F word or variation thereof. So just know before you watch with your children somewhere nearby, if you're not wanting them to hear that kind of language, just pick a different movie.
No doubt. Because this film, like, we were talking about it while the film's going on, and we're like, yeah, maybe we should have started counting. Like, maybe we should have done something every time we heard it, or, like, did something ridiculous, because it happens, like, all the time. I think we counted in one instance. It happened in the span of, like, maybe 15 seconds. It was said about 12 times.
Yeah. No joke. Not even an exaggeration.
Not at all. And that's...
because we had subtitles on, and we were counting.
jumping over to How It Ends, or I'm sorry, Extinction.
That was How It Ends, yeah.
Going over to Extinction, you have a little bit more of actual decent cast with Michael Pena, Lizzie Kaplan, and Mike Coulter, who plays Luke Cage.
He appears every once in a while.
The two main ones, though, the two strong ones, Michael Pena and Lizzie Kaplan, actually do a really decent job. They're a couple who have these two girls, and Michael Pena's having these dreams, as I mentioned, and she's playing the struggling wife who's wanting her husband to get help so that he can feel better, he can stop having these nightmares and whatnot. And I think they did a really good job translating their roles as well as what they... I don't know. How do we... I'm trying to figure out a way to state it. They translate their characters really well. Extremely well.
Well, and they have a better story to work with. I mean, if you're really trying to compare apples to oranges, the story of Extinction, the film, is a stronger story, and it was better told than the story of How It Ends, which has a great setup and just doesn't pay it off very well at all. Extinction has a really good setup. You've got some intrigue, some curiosity, some anxiety, and you get different payoffs along the way toward the end of the film.
Yeah.
However,
go ahead.
The worst part of Extinction.
Go ahead.
Was the casting of these two little girls. Every 2 seconds, they were screaming about something. Leave my mommy alone. And it was like, oh my goodness. I have never wanted to see a child die more in a movie than this one. It was too much. I couldn't handle them.
Preach.
I have never wanted to see a child die.
That is straight up savage, Spencer.
It really is. Savage.
But am I wrong?
No. Like, even for me, I'm just kind of like, I'll let you say it, but I'm just...
Well, and part of that too, here's the thing. The thing that the film that movie does intriguingly is it even pays off to a certain extent what frustrates you about it. Like, I was very frustrated for the first half or so of the movie because I was thinking, okay, this guy is having like end of the world, well, end of his family kind of premonitions, and, you know, invaders from space, and it's very dramatic. Nobody wants to believe him. Everybody's telling him to get help and he doesn't want to get help. And yet, like, the way that Michael Peña plays it,
mm-hmm.
he's fairly static. Like, he's fairly robotic about it. And his wife, Lizzie Kaplan, she has moments where she's kind of pointedly telling him, you need to go get help. Or she's working with the daughter saying, you know, daddy's sorry. He doesn't mean to be doing this, whatever. But also, her performance is a little bit wooden. And the girls were ridiculously poorly written. Like, they, all they do is whine. And that is not what you want a child character in a story of any kind to be doing. But then, I don't know, a little more than halfway through the movie, you get a bit of a, you get a big payoff.
Yeah.
Which we'll spoil in a minute. But you get a big payoff that even addresses those frustrations. The things that have annoyed you for 45 minutes to 50 minutes, you have an explanation that's like, oh, I understand why they were annoying me that way now. So in a way, it even, it overdoes, you know, serving the audience well.
Yeah.
In the sense of, it starts explaining some stuff, but then also the explanation is not just a logical explanation. It also eases your frustration with the way the characters are living their lives.
No, 100%. And that kind of hurls us into the story aspect of the film, because as we mentioned, how it ends, it's kind of this, like, it's like road trip gone bad, essentially. That's kind of how this film should have been titled, because you don't find out how it actually ends. You don't find out what the whole event was. And it's just a really bad road trip that, you know, that's the best way I can explain it.
I mean, it's a really bad road trip.
Whereas you take a look at Extinction, and Extinction, which, mind you, real quick, I was looking it up while you were talking. One of the things I think maybe that speaks into how well or how much well this film was written is that it was written by one of the guys who wrote for Black Sails. I don't know if you guys had ever seen that.
Yeah.
But that's actually a really good series. And, you know,
I really wanted to like that series. There were some elements of the plot and the characters that I just couldn't keep watching.
Ah, well, there you go. But you take a look at that particular story, and it has its ups and it has its downs. It has its, you know, its intrigue, and it has its resolution. It has its conflict, and it has its payoff. It has everything that you need for this film to create a working story, in all honesty. I mean, it has the basics for a simplified end of the world story, you know, and it works. It executes it well enough that it kept my interest, because I swear I felt like I was sitting in the car with Forrest Whitaker and Theo James. I felt like the car ride was just so long and I wanted out of the car. This one, I was like, okay, these bug-like aliens, they're coming and they're actually here and they're happening and they're shooting people and they're killing stuff. And like, I wanted to see like Michael Peña, you know, do something insane. Or I wanted to see how they were going to overcome. You know, you have instances where characters get shot and you're like, oh my gosh, they can't die. Because in the premonition, it didn't have that. It added a lot of that intrigue that I actually really liked. And it engaged me and had me sold on the story to see how it comes to fruition or how it concludes and
resolves.
Well,
and things like, why are you spent so much time in the first 40 minutes or so of this film getting glimpses of his premonition dreams, and then when the invasion actually happens, it doesn't match the premonitions. So you're sitting there thinking, okay, wait a minute, but this doesn't all match up, and maybe that's because, you know, premonitions aren't reliable 100% or whatever you want to say. But then again, you reach a point that pays off all of your frustrations.
Yeah.
It still doesn't necessarily, it didn't make me like the movie anymore necessarily, but I appreciated that they took the time to kind of explain themselves.
Yeah.
Without being overly talky about it.
No, and that's one of the good things. I agree as well, because it doesn't, I mean, in all honesty, it doesn't insult the audience. It doesn't make you feel like, oh, well, because it's a sci-fi film and because there's aliens and whatnot, and because, you know, it's Michael Peña, everybody loves Michael Peña, you need to be engaged into this and don't worry about explanation. Don't worry about it. It's just, it's taken for granted. Like, that's kind of how I felt with how it ends. Mm-hmm. I felt like, okay, because it has Forrest Whitaker in it, I'm going to follow Forrest Whitaker to the ends of the earth, which, in all honesty, I probably would, because Forrest Whitaker, I mean, it's just...
Yeah, I mean, Saul Guerrero, come on.
Seriously. but I felt like, for the sake of him being in the film and him taking lead on most of the scenes, I just kind of had to take it for granted that it was going to be explained well enough, you know? It was going to give me closure at some point, trusting in the fact that because Forrest Whitaker is in this scene or he's in this one, it's gonna give me something.
There's a reason why somebody of his caliber signs on to a project like this.
Blackmail.
Well, that's what it turns out to be.
Well, but yeah, I don't even know how to follow up from that.
Sorry. Eddie's stuck on. Now, did you say blackmail or did you say black? Male. That's where Eddie's mind is.
That's
stuck.
Actually where my head is stuck.
It's like a blockage in a pipe.
All in all,
no. Spencer saying somebody had dirt on him and said, "I will air this dirty laundry to the public if you don't do my movie." And he said, "Okay," and he did it.
It makes more sense to me.
Also, it probably took them, like, I don't know, 4 weeks to make this movie, which is pretty fast for a feature film. So you get paid quick.
That you do. I mean, no doubt there. In terms of the entire story, though, in terms of the film altogether, were there any parts of the film that you guys, aside from the obvious ones we've stated here, that you guys had more issues with or you had...
Which film?
Either or.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, by all means. Spencer. Let's start with Spencer, because I see Spencer looking to want to say something.
Okay, well, I've gotten past my little girl problem of... extinction. Basically, my main one of my other problems with how it ends is Forrest Whitaker. Because,
really?
Well, because...
Oi, okay, I believe you.
Let the man talk. He will go savage on you.
Because,
are you the one who is blackmailing him? Sheesh.
No, he's the star of this movie. He's the headliner. He's the reason you're here. He dies before the movie's end, and there's 30 minutes left in this movie.
Spoiler alert.
Hey, we did that at the beginning.
We warned
people.
I'm
just saying.
But, once he died and the movie kept going, I was like, what is happening? Why are we still here? We got to the West Coast. We picked up the girlfriend, but now there's this new scenario with this new guy, and it was like, why are we getting into another thing at this point? It seems really late in the game for that.
Yeah.
Wow.
I would agree with that. I would say in some ways, and these are completely different types of movies, and my feelings about them are very, very different. But recently, as recently as Lesson 116, we reviewed Ocean's 8.
Uh-huh.
And in a very similar way, Ocean's 8 told it a complete story, and then James Corden showed up, and they told more of the story for another 20 minutes. So while my feelings toward Ocean's 8 and my feelings toward how it ends are very different, this was a situation where, okay, you need to know whether or not, because again, to Spencer's point, Forrest Whitaker's character doesn't make it all the way to Seattle. But you need to know, once... the boyfriend slash wants to be the fiance slash baby daddy, Theo James's character, once he makes it to the West Coast, you do need to know, what does he find when he gets there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And does he find the mother of his child who's still, carrying his child?
Yeah.
It's the first scene that you see is that she's pregnant and they're both together and they're happy and they're watching the ultrasound or whatever. So... you do need to resolve that.
Yeah.
Even if it's that she didn't make it. What you don't need to do is introduce this other third wheel character and go on for another 15 minutes of awkwardness, by the way. That character, from the moment he's introduced, is very awkward. Mm-hmm. And you don't want you don't want to know who he is, where he came from, how he ended up being in the same like cabin in the woods as she is.
Yeah.
You don't need any of that. All you need to have resolved is she okay, and do they have a chance at making it?
Yeah.
It's almost impressive how awkward that guy is.
It was cringeworthy. Like, seriously.
The literal second he stepped out in like into the light, I was like, no. Like, go back.
No. I have to agree. Like, my biggest issue with that particular film, how it ends, is it gave me not enough information and it gave me too much at the same time. Like, it took for granted that I was pretty well invested into the film as well. Like, it assumed that I was on board with Theo James's character all of a sudden learning how to do all these car maneuvers all of a sudden after a road trip of 3 or 4 days with his future father-in-law. Like,
during which the future father-in-law did a lot of the driving.
Yeah, exactly. Like, when did he learn to do that? How did he learn how to do that? That makes no sense. And that ending sequence, like the last 15 minutes, he was so awkward. Like, it made me feel awkward looking at him. Like, there was no purpose as, like, it felt like once this character was introduced, you're like, okay, well, maybe they're going to do like this thing, like this, you know, love triangle thing where she's like, I'm sorry, like a Walking Dead type of thing where I'm sorry, I thought you were dead, and I
in 5 days,
I don't know, this is the what
oh, that relationship was rocky from the start. If you're over a person 5 days,
like 30 minutes he's not here, come over. I mean
he was the neighbor. I mean, who's really the father of that child? I don't know.
No, seriously, that's exactly what I was thinking too.
I thought that they were going to try to do something bigger. I didn't know why, because the movie should be over soon, but they didn't. And that was also a bit of a fail. It's like, well, then why did you do this deviation in the first place?
Yeah. Oh, man. It's like, why was he so fixed? And then it just...
Like, that dude clearly wanted the boyfriend to have never returned.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
like, he
clearly
wanted to be with the woman from that point forward.
Like, we're going
to
be together forever.
Which, in a way, even though it's a complete... It's the end of the movie, it needs to not be there, and this is a different story, but it kind of reminded me, you know, some shadings of Z for Zachariah.
Oh, yeah.
With Margot Robbie and Chris Pine and Chiwetel Ejiofor. Which is a phenomenal post-apocalyptic film, and you know, it's got that odd triangle dynamic thing presented in a new way, but there was no need for it here.
Yeah. And it was interesting because as I was thinking about it while we were talking about it, it kind of made me think about the ending of War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise, and how that ending, how he makes it to the house, his son is still alive, he runs out, his wife is whoever was taking care of them was there, you know, and they all had a hug and they all, you know, were loving on each other, and the film ends. And you're like, okay, that's resolution. I can work with that. Mm-hmm. In this aspect, it's like Tom Cruise comes home. He finds out that his son's not really his son. His daughter actually started, you know, this whole military thing, and she believes in conspiracy theories. The grandparents are actually aliens in human clothing. And all that would have been too much. All that would have, like, just completely derailed what would have been a decent sci-fi film, end of the world type scenario. This is where this film, how it ends, this is how this film kind of took on that trajectory and just went into the excess of like, yeah, you don't need that. No, you don't need him. Why is he talking like that? Why is he acting like that? Why is he holding his gun like that? Why is he looking at him like that? All these questions were unnecessary, and I just, didn't like that at all. So... I think in terms of Extinction, I don't really have any big complaints other than the two girls that we were talking about. And I think Mike Coulter's character could have did a little bit more. I think he could have been a little bit more prominent. I think he played a larger role in the beginning, and it didn't make it in the editing room floor.
Yeah, he's kind of like the explainer character.
Yeah.
By the time you get to the end of the movie, you expect him to do something really cool, and it's not that he wasn't involved in trying to save a whole lot of them, but he ends up being like I'm the one who's known what's been going on the whole time. Let me tell you what you should know. Like, he ends up being that kind of role, and you're just thinking, I mean, this is Luke Cage, for crying out loud. Like, let him punch some people. Let him throw some people through a wall or a window or, like, whatever. But he kind of is just there as a narrator almost. You know, not that he doesn't do some other things, but, yeah, he's definitely underused. And I would say that, you know, I've given a lot of compliments to Extinction in comparison to how it ends, especially. But I still can see why this movie did not go to cinemas. But I think both of them, Extinction is a more crafted and refined product than How It Ends.
Yeah.
Overall. But both of them have that straight to DVD kind of feel to them, which is what makes them perfect for Netflix distribution and not distribution to, you know, tens of thousands of cinemas.
Oh, 100%.
Nationwide or possibly worldwide.
Yeah. So with that said, let's go ahead and start with How It Ends and go ahead and give it our rating as to whether or not it passes or fails and how many monocles. I'll go ahead and start this off. I will fail the film because of the fact that just on principle alone, a end of the world film has to have some type of resolution to the actual event that is occurring. You look at every other end of the world film, most of the events have a cause, whether if it's Mad Max and the decline of just humanity and the loss of gasoline, or you're looking at Deep Impact and it's a huge comet that's heading towards the Earth. Whatever it may be, there is some type of information that is slipped over to the audience to say, hey, psst, by the way, this is what you need to know. And it doesn't insult the audience. It gives them that. So this film doesn't do that for me. So I fail it, and I'll give it one... I'll give it 1.5 monocles for Forrest Whitaker and Forrest Whitaker acting with bruised ribs, because that was probably one of the fun parts. Like, I've never heard Forrest Whitaker like groan and moan so many times, and I'm like, I actually enjoyed that. So,
wow, sadist.
One monocle for Forrest Whitaker and half a monocle for his bruised ribs.
They were broken. They were like protruding through his skin.
They were. And no. It was his acting, and that was just superb. What about you, Spence?
No, this movie fails because finish your movies, people. fails because I don't know what's happening. I don't know if they survived at the end. They could be dead. The whole planet could be dead. I don't know, and that's
and
why
we
it
still don't know why.
Yes,
like what happened? Yeah, shrug.
Yeah, that's my
I problem. Mean, the movie kind of gives you a giant shrug emoji at the end. It's like,
guys, what if the entire world had actually died, and this was like an allegory or like a metaphor for like Dante's Inferno?
Stop!
I just
what?
Don't look don't, at me like that. He's talking about
because he
me.
Finds the girl. Okay, go.
Mad Max, Fury Road.
Okay, this
you got me.
This is one out of five for me.
There you go. Chad.
How It Ends fails and gets, I would give it a single monocle as well, mainly because I still thought the premise was strong, even though the payoff didn't really exist at all.
All right. And then
I would watch a better movie with the same setup.
True. I think sums it up really well.
Yeah, like, I don't think it's a bad setup at all.
No, not at all. All right, well then let's go around and go ahead and talk about Extinction. I will let Spencer take this one for the lead.
All right, so for Extinction...
Does it pass or fail and how many monocles?
Okay, I guess I'll pass it. But it's like... those girls were very annoying.
You are struggling with
huge
this.
Huge point deduction there.
Like, that is my main problem with the
I don't
movie
care
right
if the little
there.
Girl is related to Jacob Tremblay.
Like,
which she is, the youngest one.
Like, that was my massive problem with this movie, which is kind of insane, but it is. Like, Spencer. I could not deal with it. So I'll give this movie a 2 because they bothered me that much. It actually was a really good story. I felt like it worked better than How It Ends did. So,
Chad,
Extinction. Okay. I'm going to spoil something in the way that I wrap this up
myself.
So I will pass the film. The only reason that it passes for me is because the explanation for why everybody acts so wooden and robotic is because they are androids.
Bum, bum, bum.
So you learn that at the beginning of the climax of the film. You have it confirmed. But I think I was very, very distracted, even though I could tell because we watched it. We watched this film second after How It Ends. And we were all frustrated with how it ends. And so watching this one, like from the outset, I was sitting there thinking, oh, this is a better told story. Okay, I'm going to like it. But then you've got somebody like Michael Peña, who is known for being very animated in his roles, acting like a robotic person with no emotions.
Yeah.
Like he should have emotions, and there's a hint of like an almost emotion every once in a while, but there's not really any range. There's no dynamic presentation of the conflict that his character has, which is very intense, and everybody else around him makes note of it at the drop of a dime. But his reaction and his way of being is very frustrating.
Yeah.
So the fact that the explanation is, well, that's because they're all robots. All the main characters that you're following, they're all robots. Okay, that does actually ease some of my frustrations. However, it's Michael Peña. I don't want to watch Michael Peña being like...
Subdued.
Subdued, yeah. Like, it's a perfect description. And hardly ever, ever, ever having anything above like a 5 out of 10 reaction to anything, including his wife getting shot, his daughter almost being stabbed through the face, like... Yeah. All kinds of things that should totally set somebody off. And he's like, like kind of normal. So that's a meandering way of saying, because the explanation was what it was, that they're all robots and it helped ease my frustrations. That's the only reason that this movie passes for me. I would fail it otherwise. Even though it did have better graphics and was more elegantly told than the other one. In terms of overall monocles, I think I'm going to settle with a 2 as well because those girls were really annoying.
It's the worst.
And the explanation wasn't really enough for me.
Well, for me, I will pass the film. I do think the plot twist, if you will, was very M. Night Shyamalan-esque in terms of like realizing like all we were missing was like the music from Signs. You know, the way that the whole soundtrack works. I think of that every time I see like a plot twist in anything.
That's terrible for you.
Hey, you know, it was a good soundtrack. Don't hate. But I have to agree with Chad. Like Michael Peña is a very expressive actor. He emotes very well and he's very much engaged with how his character reacts to certain things. He's very animated, and I expected, like, when his wife got shot, I expected him to react like how he did in Crash, like when he thought his daughter got shot in Crash.
Oh, mercy.
And that whole scene, like, I as any, you know, anybody who finds that somebody important to them gets shot, there's a strong reaction. I mean, just plain and simple. So to see how much subdued he had to be for this particular performance, it worked in translating like the whole idea of them being robots, but I still like Michael Peña is not some, nobody puts Michael Peña in a corner, plain and simple.
That's not the Michael Peña you want to see.
Exactly. So it does pass in terms of story, but the girls and subduing Michael Peña do penalize it a bit. So I would have to give it a 2 monocles as well. I think the film is a strong concept, but you need to, number one, better cast, and number two, you need to be able to just really give strong direction to your child actors. I mean, unfortunately, that's kind of where a lot of that goes. Like, you need to really recognize that when it comes to working with kids. I think Orson Welles said it best. He said, whenever you make a film, don't work with two things. Don't work with animals and don't work with kids. And I'm pretty sure there's truth in that somewhere. So,
sure.
I mean, in this aspect, I think this is where it rings true. And it really does kind of ding the film for me. So I give it 2 monocles out of 5. it does pass, and that's how I feel.
Now, I will say it's a somewhat decent prequel to the Matrix trilogy.
Oh, my gosh. No. No.
It explains what happens to make those robots the way they are.
Ah, well, since we're not doing conspiracy theories on the show anymore. But that about wraps up another episode of The Film Philosophers. Let us know what you think. How do you feel about these films? Obviously, they're on Netflix, so if you have access to an account or the streaming service, check them out. Let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page or our Twitter page. We'd love to hear you talk about it. We'd love to hear you mention your thoughts. As well, check out our other previous episodes on filmphilosophers.com, where you can catch all 130-plus episodes. We've got over 130!
Yeah, we do.
So, before we go, we're going to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. You got The House with a Clock in Its Walls, which is an extremely long title. You got Sister Brothers, and you got Colette. So, this weekend's not as strong as other weekends, but...
I think it's the Sisters Brothers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not Sister Brothers.
I thought it was the Sister
Brothers. That's a very different kind of movie.
No, it's about a pair of brothers whose last name is
Sisters. The Sisters Brothers.
The Sisters Brothers. You
it's
guys
like
are
a Western, right?
Yeah.
John C. Reilly and...
Joaquin Phoenix.
Yes.
So, yeah, check out those films or stay home and watch Netflix and let us know what you thought about these films. Check out our extra credit episode as well as we dive deep into something that was dropped this week and we just felt like we needed to talk about it a little bit more. So stick around and check out that episode because it'll be fun.
Marvelous.
I saw what you did there.
So clever.
So from all of us here at the Film Philosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.